now more than ever, people need to go within and plug into that cellular memory, plug into divine source, detach as much as possible from the matrix.
Hello again, everybody, and welcome to the Cosmic Switchboard. Our guest today is an independent historian, student of military history with an emphasis on intelligence, counterintelligence, and special operations. He has investigated alien abductions, the reptilian overlordship, and military abductions for over 25 years. He has had his own alien and reptilian encounters as well as my lab experiences. He is an international speaker and is working on his first book project. So without any further ado, here is James Bartley. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really looking forward to this interview segment with you.
You're welcome. Today, James and I decided that you guys hear a lot from other people, but you haven't heard an interview from James, and we thought you'd be interested in hearing about stuff that happened to James and his experiences. So today I'm going to ask James questions and he's going to answer the questions. If we skip anything or there is anything you'd like to know after the show, send us an email and we can answer it and put it in next week's commentary or on the website or send you a reply. So James, first let's start with, tell us some of the experiences that led you into this work.
Yes, and of necessity, some of the information I share may sound repetitive or redundant. For those of you that are somewhat familiar with my story, you may have heard me talk about some of these issues on other people's shows. But for those who have never heard my side of the story, I think it's beneficial to them. And I will do my best to mix in a lot of, I wouldn't call it new information, but information you may not have heard about me in the past. I'm a lifelong alien contactee, abductee, and have known for some time that I've had military abduction experiences. And it should be understood that when I say that I've had ET encounters and ET experiences, it runs the gamut. Countless dreams throughout my life of ETs, UFOs, UFO dream invasions, also astral experiences, astral abductions, mystical type experiences, missing time experiences. I've had a lifelong interest in the subject of UFOs and alien life forms, as I've had a lifelong interest in other interesting subjects like the Bermuda Triangle, Sasquatch, Bigfoot, other dimensions, ancient civilizations, advanced ancient civilizations. I've always had an interest, but I never realized I myself was having the experiences until 1990. Now, I suspected the subject matter of aliens and UFOs and alien abductions. On the one hand, I was very interested about learning as much as I could about it, but on the other hand, the interest level would reach a peak. It would plateau out, because when it came to personal encounters, abduction encounters, you know, fear and trepidation would kick in. So growing up, I was familiar and aware of the broad outlines of the Travis Walton abduction story. That happened, I believe, what was it, 75? I would have been 11 years old. I remember reading about the Charles Hickson Calvin Parker abduction encounter in Pascagoula, Mississippi. That happened in 73. And then I read a book about that included that case. I think it was Ralph Blum's book, UFOs from Outer Space or something like that. And I've always had an interest in the subject, and intermittently throughout the years I would have dreams about UFOs, would see unusual light phenomena, would see UFOs in the sky, sometimes at quite close range, including a cigar-shaped craft which was bigger than a city bus. It was orange-reddish on the side. It had a large double row of what appeared to be windows with bright yellow light streaming out of it, and at the tail end of this, there was a short reddish flame about 3 or 4 feet that was coming out of the rear end, and it was making this whooshing sound, whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. And I had two other independent witnesses. My late great first German Shepherd, Brandy, was sitting at the gate with her head cocked to one side and her ears pointed forward, she was looking at this thing the same way I was. I was looking out the window of the living room. It was a commercial break. It was Channel 44, for those of you that grew up in Daly City, Channel 44 was a UHF station, and I was watching a war movie, an Errol Flynn war movie, with my mom. It was called Objective Burma. And during the first commercial break, I looked out the window, and I can see this cigar-shaped craft slowly moving across my field of vision. I got up off the sofa, and I looked out the window, and I noticed Brandy, the German Shepherd, with her head tilted to the side. I heard clearly the whooshing sound. I don't think my mom was in the room at the time. She may have taken a bathroom break. Years later, I had another independent witness, an old buddy of mine, who I believe has since passed away. His name is Joel, although I didn't know he'd had the same UFO sighting, and I didn't know he was an alien abductee till many years later. But Joel says that around that same time period, he and his mom were taking a nightly walk through the neighborhood, and whereas I saw this cigar-shaped craft at low altitude, I would say about 10, 15 feet above the ground, it must have gained altitude because by the time it got to his street, which was only a block or two over, and he and his mom were out walking at night, he saw the underside of this thing. He said it was a cigar shape from beneath, but beneath, and it just shows the different perspectives at work, he saw a dazzling array of just multicolored lights from beneath. So me, from my perspective, I saw the side of this, reddish-orange on the side, about the size of wider than a double-decker London bus, and reddish-orange on the side with a big row of double windows with yellow light pouring out of it. And at the rear end, I saw the little red flame and the whooshing sound. But from underneath, he saw what was kind of, from his perspective, almost a cigar quasi-banana shape from beneath. But underneath, he saw a dazzling array of lights of different colors, and it slowly flew overhead. And he and his mom both saw this, and he said it was right around the same time period that I saw my sighting. So, and it turned out later on that Joel was an alien abductee because he was out fishing with a buddy of mine, Alex, who I'd known for years. And both Joel and Alex were fishing at San Luis Reservoir. They'd, you know, taken a few nights off and went fishing there, and where I fished before, San Luis Reservoir in Central California, getting towards Northern California. And they had a missing time experience, and they both woke up with scoop marks on their shins, plain as day. And then upon questioning both Joel and Alex, it turned out that they were lifelong alien abductees. Right, so it turns out that some of the buddies that I had, that I hung out with, partied with countless times, find out further down the track years later that they both had alien abduction experiences, and they lived within blocks of me. Right, growing up, I mean, in our formative years in San Jose, California, northern San Jose, California, not too far from Milpitas, the border. That was a high UFO activity area too. To this day, just thinking about San Jose, California gives me the shivers because of all the experiences I had there. But the point of relevance is, and getting back to your question, Dean, is that I've always been interested in the subject, but I've always had kind of a arm's length interest in it, simply because I'm open-minded and I'm interested in all kinds of different things. And then much later down the track, after I came back from Germany in 1990, I had a series of full-blown encounters, and then I did what I call a life review, and I realized that intermittently throughout my life, nosebleeds when I was a boy, waking up when I was a young boy with my jammies inside out and backwards, and my underwear inside out and backwards, and the booties, I wore those onesie pajamas, gray pajamas. I look like Bugs Bunny without the ears, right? And the bottoms of the booties beneath my feet, I would wake up in the morning, there would be dirt, stickers, and mud sometimes, as if I'd been outside during the night. And my family would find me many times anywhere but where they had put me to sleep, which was the upper bunk of a bunk bed, right? Somehow they would find me in the living room, on the bedroom floor, etc., etc. I never woke up with bumps and bruises from falling off the bunk bed. It was just that the stupid ETs would never return me properly to where I needed to be. And so when I did that life review upon returning from Germany in 1990, and I thought about all the alien dreams I've had, the UFO dreams, I actually ran away from a UFO abduction in the late 70s, early 80s. I was coming home late at night, walking through my neighborhood, actually, you know, leaving Alex's house and then heading quite close to Joel's house. I saw a UFO heading straight to me, right? And I ran home. In fact, I had to run towards it before I made a left turn, you know, headed to my street. And I was like Ricky Henderson rounding third base heading for home, and I was running as fast as I could, and I can see out of the corner of my eye this craft just saying, forget about it, and just kind of lifting off and heading in another direction. Like, I guess it gave up on me. That's what I think. I could have had a missing time experience and don't remember it. But anyway, long story short, Dean, coming back in 1990 and having a series of full-blown ET UFO experiences, at some at close range and culminating in a full-blown waking up surrounded by three reptilian greys and then being taken up into their ship, I was really frightened. I was really scared. I was skittish. I kept the lights on. You know, loud sudden noises would spook me. I would yelp and scream, and sometimes when I'd hear sudden noises. But the fear was, I wouldn't say counterbalanced, but the fear was somewhat tempered by my curiosity. And so I embarked on an intensive study about the subject, and lo and behold, I found out before very long that there was a military component to this, that the military had known about ETs going back at least to the 1940s, at least, and probably before then.
I have a question for you. You mentioned that there was a lot of UFO and ET activity around San Jose. Do you think it's a coincidence that Silicon Valley is so close to San Jose and a lot of our technology is coming out of there?
That's a very good question, because there are some not-so-secret underground bases in the South Bay, even been written about in the local newspapers. I'm talking about places like Cupertino, Camden, South San Jose. The locals there, in the areas that abut the what is known as the East Foothills, they hear loud explosions, they hear loud noises underground. And basically it emerged that there was an underground aerospace facility there in the South Bay, right? And so that's even been written about in the local newspapers. And then in the East Foothills, there is a large underground base there. There was a period of time, and Alex and I talked about this. Oh, and I'll tell you an Alex story after this, too, that has direct relation to that part of the East Foothills in San Jose, the South Bay. Okay, for those of you that are not familiar with the geography, San Francisco is 50 miles north of San Jose. And my dad was stationed with Naval Air Station Alameda. He was on board one of the aircraft carriers that used to be stationed there. Back then, NAS, Naval Air Station Alameda, was the home port of, you know, certain aircraft carriers. And my dad was stationed in Alameda, and we lived in Daly City, California. And then when he knew he was going to be stationed at Naval Air Station Moffett Field, which is the north side of the Santa Clara Valley, where basically this is where Silicon Valley starts, technically, right? So in preparation for his being stationed, about 74, 75 time frame, in Naval Air Station Moffett, we moved to San Jose, California, which would have made it only about a 15-minute commute, right? I think it was Highway 17 from San Jose headed north. So let me get back to the East Foothills. There was a large amount of military activity, the large double-rotored helos, the Chinooks, and lots of vehicular convoy traffic, all headed for the East Foothills. And what happened one night, Alex was walking home, and he was jumped. He was jumped by a big Mexican guy, and the guy was in the process of pummeling Alex to death, right? And then suddenly, get this, a beam of light had shone from the East Foothills. This is at night. Shone from the East Foothills, and beamed all the way across from the East Foothills to North San Jose, where we lived, went right into his forehead, and a voice clearly said, "Get up and run." Because the guy, who knows, he could have been, okay, this is going to sound like, you know, racial stereotyping. I don't give a rat's ass. But who knows, the guy could have been on PCP. He could have just been, you know, like a serial killer. You don't know, right? So Alex was knocked to the ground, and the guy was coming after him. The beam of light, this like bluish-white beam of light, came from the East Foothill Mountains all the way into his head and said, "Get up and run." Right, and Alex, right, he got up and ran, and he got away from this nut job, right? And so, but that was the same place, the same general area where we were seeing all this military activity, double rotored helos, large helo transports, smaller helicopters, etc., etc. There's a similar place, now that I'm on the subject, in East County, San Diego. If you start heading towards, you know, beyond El Cajon, start heading towards Jacumba in Southern California, like from San Diego and head eastbound. You know the direction I'm talking about, Dean, on Highway 8. Beyond this mountain range, secret military activity there. What was funny was when I worked at the airbase at Naval Air Station North Island, this entrepreneurially minded officer, he was a commander. You know, a lot of military people, they have businesses on the side because the military just doesn't pay enough. And he was into real estate. Took a series of panoramic pictures of this mountain range in East County, San Diego, out beyond El Cajon. And he brought it to our office in communications because we had a big Xerox Majestic printer there. And he asked for a series of copies. And as I'm making copies for this Navy commander, I noticed this big object. Like in the background, I began zooming in, expanding the image over and over and over. Lo and behold, it's a huge flying saucer, right? Hovering above the mountain range in broad daylight, right? That's another place similar to the East Foothills in San Jose. So I'm trying to paint a word picture to the listeners, okay? So it's 50 miles south of San Francisco, you have the Santa Clara Valley. And at the south end of the Santa Clara Valley, you have the East Foothills. And in the south end of Santa Clara Valley, you have communities like Camden, Cupertino. And in that area, there's a not-so-secret underground base where this official cover story is they were testing, if memory serves, boosters for rockets, which explained the loud explosive noises. Now, you asked about Silicon Valley, Dean, and what relevance it has to the ET connection. Well, the northern part of Santa Clara Valley is what we call Silicon Valley. It must be understood, dear listeners, San Jose and Santa Clara at one time was one huge orchard, right? This is, think about Luther Burbank, the geneticist who was like creating all these different strains of flowers, plants, and vegetables that previously, you know, not existed, right? Well, all that started in the Santa Clara Valley, San Jose. Back then, the place was just one big orchard. I used to walk home and just pluck apricots and nectarines and cherries off the trees and hide up in the cherry trees and munch out, right? Anyway, what happened was they started to build Silicon Valley adjacent and around Naval Air Station Moffett Field. Let me start with NAS Moffett Field. That's where NASA Ames is, NASA Ames Research Center, right? And also, according to the research of the late great Leonard Stringfield, NAS Moffett, if you're driving on, I don't know what they call it now, but they used to call it Highway 17, north or southbound, you see these huge hangars there at NAS Moffett. The reason there's huge hangars is because back in the day, when the U.S. Navy still had dirigibles, right, they used to store them there at Naval Air Station Moffett Field, which they would use for, you know, patrolling the ocean and anti-submarine patrols, etc., etc. According to Leonard Stringfield, the Navy had stored a captured, recovered flying saucer or alien craft of some kind there in one of those big hangars at Naval Air Station Moffett Field. So you have NASA Ames Research Center there that shares the facility with Naval Air Station Moffett Field. And because of the base realignment and closure, what they call BRAC, Naval Air Station Moffett Field is now a federal airfield, okay? So apparently, I guess the Navy doesn't use it or own it anymore. The federal government does. Now, Lockheed made a claim for that airfield as well because quite close, former NAS Moffett Field, Lockheed's Missile and Space Division, a very spooky place. It's the place where they build the spy satellites for the National Reconnaissance Office and the National Security Agency. They build a lot of the satellites there, right there in Mountain View, Sunnyvale area. And they build missiles there too. And Lockheed, at one point, tried to buy up some of the airfield there in order to fly out their satellites and fly in technicians. Quite close to the Lockheed Missile and Space Division, very spooky place, is the so-called Blue Cube. What the Blue Cube is an NSA, National Security Agency, National Reconnaissance Office, satellite tracking facility. And they have these in different places around the world. Greenland, for example, is another one. Pine Gap is another one that's alleged to be a satellite tracking facility in Australia. But right there in Sunnyvale is the Blue Cube. And then you have all these semiconductor firms. Back then it would have been Fairchild. Oh, AMD is also there. AMD, they build tanks and they build armored personnel carriers and armored vehicles, right? I think the Bradley fighting vehicle was built there. And you just have all these corporations there, Fairchild, AMD, Intel. As a matter of fact, in Milpitas, I worked at a semiconductor firm where the product we made was the lead frames. And the lead frames would have multiple legs on it. And the silicon chip sits in the middle of the lead frame, right? And we made the lead frames for the space shuttle and just for a variety of other products. And we had RCA as customers, Intel, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all the big Texas Instruments made lots of parts for them. So that was in the northern part of the Santa Clara Valley, which we now call Silicon Valley. And Silicon Valley's had a horrendous impact on the environment. I remember when I was a kid, you go into the creeks of San Jose, and there would be amphibians all over the place. There'd be frogs, tadpoles, salamanders, crayfish, eels. But what happened was Silicon Valley corporations began dumping a lot of their toxic swill into the canals and creeks and whatnot, and pretty soon all that wildlife died out. But getting back to your question, Dean, do I think that there's a connection between the ET presence in the South Bay and the fact that, well, Apple, another one, Apple Computers started there, right? IBM, Apple Computers, it's all there, right? So I do think there's definitely a connection, because it's been alleged, for example, that Apple Computers was passed on alien technology by the military-industrial complex, and they were asked to see what they can do with this technology. And I just did this commentary last week about AI, right? And how Apple is coming out with this new and improved AI, like we really need some more of it.
The FPGAs are only made by a few companies, and Chinese can't knock them off. And same with the computer processors, and they're all coming out of that area.
Yes, they are all coming out of that area. So if there's going to be a place where recovered alien technology, back-engineered technology, think of the late Philip Corso, Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso, who claimed he was with Army Research and Development. And I have no reason to doubt him. All these blowhards in the field, people like Stanton Friedman and others, just say, oh, you know, there's no proof, blah, 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 quack, 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 right? No, it makes perfect sense that they would cede this recovered technology to the corporations, because ultimately the corporations owned it anyway, because the corporations own the military. You know, the Stanton Friedmans of the world, they can't figure this out, right? He made this one idiotic comment about, well, whatever nation controls alien technology will control the world. What nations? The powers that be don't see nations. The powers that be see only one global entity, which they are in control of. They don't think in terms of nation states. We do, because we believe in sovereignty and nationhood, etc., etc. And we used to have pride in our countries until the social engineers got involved. See, that's just an ignorant statement when he says the country, i.e., I guess he's thinking about the U.S., that controls alien technology will one day control the world. right? But as you know, it's got nothing to do with countries. So what they've done in order to create this artificial intelligence influence world is seed alien technology through the corporations, just as the late Lieutenant Colonel Philip Corso talked about. Okay, and I knew about Philip Corso before he became public with his revelations in his book because of my studies of special operations, black ops, and MIAs, missing in action, POWs that were left over, and long before Laos and Cambodia and Vietnam. There were so many that were lost and left over from the tail end of World War II and the Korean War. I heard about Philip Corso testifying before Congress about MIA issues. That's where I first heard about him. So he was plugged in at a very high level to all kinds of secrets, right? And so when he comes along later on talking about how Roswell technology and the like was seeded into industry by the military, that makes perfect sense to me. And there's no better place to do that than Silicon Valley. So I definitely think, and also when you consider, Dean, that, okay, if you're just going to take a cross-section of society, a swath of society, if you will, how many of those engineers, how many of those technicians in Silicon Valley are alien abductees themselves? My mentor, Barbara Bartholik, debriefed a headhunter for a Silicon Valley firm. His job is to go out and recruit people for his particular Silicon Valley firm. He himself was a meth addict, and he was being messed with by Greys and other entities. In fact, they manipulated him into watching child pornography, right? Because they got into his head and they changed around his neural circuitry, et cetera, via the meth, right? So that's a classic example of someone who works in Silicon Valley who is under malign alien influence to the point where he was watching child porn, right? So we must never forget the potential that exists for non-human life forms to work through their hybridized alien abductees seated throughout society, but in particular in places like Silicon Valley and the military-industrial complex in general. And there's no telling what kinds of ideas that would be implanted into these people's minds in muse-like fashion. So, yeah, long-winded answer, Dean. I absolutely feel that the growth of Silicon Valley has everything to do with this alien presence. And also I talked about some of those agencies and like Lockheed, Missile and Space, and the NSA Tracking Facility, and NASA Ames, et cetera, all those places at some level are deeply involved and or influenced by this non-human alien presence.
That's very interesting. I mean, when you use your computer, you don't consider that the processor inside is alien technology.
Yes. When you look at, for example, what Philip Corso mentioned, right? The things we take for granted today, the night vision goggles, actually was the result of analysis and back engineering of those black eye pieces that some of the ETs have over their eyes. They realized through analysis that those black eye pieces allowed the ETs to be able to see better in the dark, right? And also the recovered foil-like metals in the Roswell debris field, how it had tensile memory. It could be crushed up into a ball and then you'd open your hand up and then it would flatten itself out like water. And nowadays they have like alloys that have tensile memory. And then they talked about some of the tube-like things they found in the debris field, which sounds a lot like what you would call fiber optics today, right? And there are people out there, the cherry pickers, you know, they come from all roads lead back to the Germans as far as advanced technology is concerned, which I think is nonsense, right? I'm not discounting the Germans had connections with ETs from Aldebaran, et cetera, et cetera. I believe that's quite possible, indeed likely. But the notion that all this advanced technology, the Roswell craft, crash retrieval, et cetera, is all merely the recovery of German technology is patently absurd. And what the cherry pickers do is they look for, in broad outline, technology that the Germans were working on and say, oh, look, this is reminiscent to what they found in the Roswell debris field. Ergo, that must prove that was actually a German craft that was recovered in Roswell because the Germans were working on the same thing. who's to say that the aliens weren't implanting similar thoughts to German engineers and German electricians, technicians, and engineers? And that doesn't explain away all the bodies that were found living and dead in Roswell as well as the unusual, strange nature of the technology. So, you know, I just want to put to bed this, and people can believe whatever they want, right? But I look at credibility. Who has more credibility? You know, the people that were at Roswell and at the various other bases, Wright Field, who'd seen alien bodies, who'd seen the alien technology, or these people that show up decades later saying that it was all a hoax or it was, you know, some misidentification of a missile or some other nonsense. But anyway, Dean, I do believe that there's definitely a connection.
Now, James, a lot of people who are just getting into this or are first having experiences don't know whether they're having a dream, a nightmare, a spiritual encounter, some kind of astral thing, or an alien abduction. So how would somebody know if their experience is real and what it is?
That's a very good question, Dean. I must qualify what I say next with the fact that the whole nature, the intended purpose behind screen memories, behind memory erasure, selective memory erasure, is precisely to keep us in the dark about all of this, not just alien abduction encounters, but also about military MILAB encounters, right? There's a lot of mind control and selective memory erasure and implanting of screen memories, et cetera, et cetera. So it's easy for one to say that one must be familiar with their own mind, but I believe that is the template, the baseline, that we have to recognize, whether it's at the time or later on with the benefit of hindsight, what constitutes a regular dream, for example, and what constitutes a stage-managed dream, a dream that's been inputted into one's own mind when asleep, right? Like I said at the outset, ET encounters run the gamut of physical, astral, dream experiences, etc. So I'm going to kind of take it in turns talking about different aspects of it. Like, for example, most dreams, for people that are not lucid dreamers, they seem like, however fragmented our memories of them the next morning are, they seem like a series of juxtaposed images that go by in lightning sequence, which have no relevance or coherence. Some of the dreams may have an internal coherence where we seem to be somewhere, we seem to be doing something, we seem to be a group of people. This seems to be a plot, if you will, right? Other dreams are just like a collage of images, all juxtaposed one after the other and coming in lightning sequence that really, it's kind of like your brain or your mind is kind of slewing off all this stuff, you know, whatever preoccupations we have during the day or, you know, in that particular stage of our life, it's a way for us, our subconscious, to process a lot of things, right? Well, what differentiates that with an alien-related dream is the alien-related dreams have an immediacy to them, a poignancy. You feel like you're there. At times, you feel like a cornered rat or a cornered animal where you're just compelled to see and experience things. You see UFOs flying overhead at, you know, low altitude. You see, you're in your house. I had a lot of UFO-related dreams with my brother, my younger brother. And we would be in our house in San Jose, and oftentimes there'd be no furniture there, strangely enough. And we had a skylight above one part of our house, and we would see, like, lights, lighted craft hovering slowly, you know, hovering or moving slowly right above the skylight, illuminating the roof and light shining through the ceiling. And then we'd look out the windows out of the sides of the house, and we'd see like craft flying at low altitude slowly circling the house. So we would have these dreams, he and I would have them alone, and he would also have his own dreams, but he would figure prominently in a number of my dreams when I was younger, where we're in a house and we're being besieged by low-flying craft in the middle of the night and no one else is home. It's just us, right? And then there would be dreams that would have kind of a symbolic. Carl Jung talks about how he talks a lot about archetypes, you know, Jungian archetypes, and how dreams can be an example of how archetypes manifest from our subconscious. And so what these, not just aliens, but I believe interdimensional, hyperdimensional beings of different types also work through symbols in our dreams, where they'll create a stage-managed dream, an externally induced dream. It's of a very symbolic, stylized, theatrical presentation, where we're shown a number of things, where these non-human life forms, intelligence, could be there, and they could be showing us things, taking us places in the astral dreamscape, maybe even taking us to other dimensions, higher dimensions. And sometimes, like in one dream I remember, and by this point, I'd long since realized that I can astral travel and that at times I could fly in my dreams. In this one dream, I found myself in, it was like a big stage set, but it was meant to give me the impression that I was outdoors at night. And if you remember the old cartoons with the Flintstones, how the backgrounds would always be the same, it would be like the same, you know, stone houses, the same kind of Flintstones era buses and cars, and it was the same loop over and over and over in the background. It was similar to that, where I'd look up and there would be a series of craft flying through the sky slowly, and they had an internal light source that would kind of pulse, like a pulsing light source that reminded me of like a heartbeat for some reason, and they would glow from the inside, and they had this internal light source that pulsed, and they would be in different shapes, and it was like a black exterior, and this light source would pulse inside of them, giving me the impression these craft were actually real. But as I stood below and looked up and watched it, I realized it was the same craft over and over, like the same several craft of different shapes that would pass by in my field of vision. It was like they were just showing me something for some reason. So the point of relevance, Dean, is that, okay, that's clearly a dream where some external source was pumping these images into my mind to elicit a kind of an emotional, psychological reaction and response within me. And compare that to how the dreams are for most people, just a series of juxtaposed images that don't really have any coherence or any kind of internal consistency, right? So that's just the dreams. Now, as far as the physical experiences are concerned, what happens sometimes is, and many researchers have talked about this, we are left with physical after effects, physical marks, if you will. Like, one can have a dream about ETs coming into their bedroom and seeing like a bright light or a light coming through a window, coming down through the ceiling, coming through the wall, and seeing, and the ETs manifest in a number of ways. They can come in like in a big glowing orb, and then the orb takes shape and turns into one or more little grays or little ETs. Other times you're just brought right through the ceiling. Well, it's happened to me many times, like, well, it floated right through the ceiling. But whatever the case may be, you may wake up with a fragmented memory of the experience, or it may manifest to you the memories in the morning as a dream, like, well, that was a crazy dream last night of these little beings coming in my bedroom, etc., etc. But there are, at times, telltale after effects. There are scars. There are scoop marks. I've got a triangular mark on my on one of my knees, and on my other knee, I have a scoop mark. And they can leave, like, burn marks, what seem to be burn marks, which paradoxically there's no discomfort where these marks are. I've had a very dark, like magenta red, kind of irregularly shaped mark on my arms before, and you would think, man, that, you know, it looks like it hurts, but no, it didn't. And then mysteriously, in a day or two, they were gone, and I've woken up with patterns, triangular marks, not only triangular shape marks, but a number of marks arranged in a triangular pattern. Now, the triangle seems to be a symbol of, I believe, the symbol of the reptilians, because what people perceive to be a triangle, I think they're actually looking at a trikona. And when you think of the ancient Hindu kalas and the Hindu cosmology, a trikona is what we would call an inverted pyramid or an inverted triangle. So when people look at this mark on their arm or their leg, oh, that's a triangle. Well, what if it's a trikona? And a trikona symbolizes the kundalini serpent energy. Okay, tip there, right? So, you know, look up that term, T-R-I-K-O-N-A. And so one can find after effects, marks. And also there's the fact that sometimes you're physically missing, right? Someone will go into your bedroom, knock on your bedroom door, and you're just not there. It's because the ETs have come and taken you away. They've floated you through the ceiling, floated you through a window, opened up a portal, or just teleported you right out of there, right? So there's a number of ways people can determine if something's really going on. But your question about the screen memories is important too, because it goes back to knowing your own mind, right? Okay, what constitutes like a regular dream and what constitutes a more elaborate, stylized, highly symbolic, externally imposed, stage-managed dream? And it's the same way with the screens, right? Because sometimes what they do with the screen memories, Dean, what they do is they have a way of plugging into our information field, our memory banks, if you will, and knowing the people, the animals, the places you've been, that you've interacted with, people, places, and things, right? So what they used to do with me, because, you know, I've had dogs, you know, different stages of my life, what they would do is they would make me think I was playing with one of my, with my dogs in the past. For example, my third German Shepherd, Mac, right? The reptilians would have him come into my dream, or the image of Mac, and it was what I call a stage-managed dream. I'd be playing and wrestling and rolling around on the ground with Mac, but really what it was a means by the reptilians to explain away the part of my mind that was still conscious, the physical sensations I was feeling, because they were touching me, prodding me, rolling me around, and so they created this dream theater in my mind of, you know, me playing with Mac, which explained the physical sensations, the sensate, tactile feelings, right? And then on another occasion, and I knew that wasn't Mac because, you know, I was petting Mac, and then at one point I stroked Mac's fur in a certain direction, and I felt scales. I said, oh, shite, right? And then I realized immediately what was going on. The thing tried to mess with me at that point. I had to fight it off, right? Because it wasn't Mac after all. On another occasion, and I think the Greys may have been doing this, they created this dream scenario where I was with a whole bunch of little puppies, and these puppies were just, you know, dogpiling me. They were, you know, like jumping all over me and rolling over me and, you know, playfully kind of like nudging me and tickling me, etc., etc. But what was really going on, the ETs, whoever they were, I have this third eye vision of them being Greys for some reason. The dream image of the little puppies jumping all over me and, you know, wrestling and rolling around with me on the ground, it was meant for me to confuse, you know, to not realize what the real touching and what the real rolling over was all about. But what the ETs were doing were rolling me around. They'd roll me on my side. They'd roll me on my tummy. They'd roll me on my back. But in the dream, I was having all these little puppies crawling all over me, right? It's just a means to explain away, again, the physical sensations of being touched, of being rolled over, et cetera, et cetera. And they will do this with little kids. You can have a dream of like a little, you know, you're playing with a little kid, the kid's jumping in your arms, you know, you're carrying the kid piggyback on your back and having a, you know, grand old time. But really, it's just to explain away, so to speak, the sensations you're feeling. Make you think you're having a dream, playing with your child, playing with your neighbor's child, or your sister's child, your niece, whatever, right? But really, there's some little ET touching you, right? Touching you, rolling you over. They'll combine the imagery in the stage-managed dream with the physical sensations to make it seem like it's just a dream that has, you know, like a physical, tactile, sensate aspect to it. And so that's another thing people have to be aware of. And also the screens that they use, like a very common screen is owls in the dreams or the actual abduction experiences, or beings with large heads and large eyes, right? Be it like cows or moose or chimps, baboons, et cetera, right? Something that our rational mind would say, okay, it kind of looks like a baboon, it kind of looks like a big rabbit, it kind of looks like, you know, like Casper the Friendly Ghost, but really it's not. It's an ET. They're just trying to use images that they know, that they extracted from our information field, from our memory banks, if you will, to make us buy into the illusion, right? Like, for example, I once had a memory come back to me of what may have been an actual abduction, which which came to me. I can't remember at this moment if it was in a dream or if it was like a sudden like memory that, you know, came into my mind. But what happened was I had this memory all of a sudden come over me that I'm driving along at night, and suddenly the car I'm driving, which I actually owned that car at the time, right? It was a little 5-speed. In the dream or the memory, I can't really remember what it was, suddenly the whole car is lifted up off the ground in the middle of the night. I'm driving along a road at night, and suddenly the whole car is lifted up in the air, and I start screaming my head off, right? And so, looking back now, I think it was a dream, and I woke up the next morning just freaking out because it felt so real, right? So I think that what I remembered on that occasion was an actual experience I had where I'm driving along at night in a certain car, and then I would just float it up in the sky, car and all, you know what I mean? So.
Now, a lot of people say that the abductions are really a spiritual or interacting with some kind of a demon or something like that. So how would somebody know if it's an alien pretending to be a demon or a demon pretending to be an alien or something else?
Well, you're just full of good questions today, Dean. That's a very good question. And, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, of course, and have a lot of water, you know, going under the bridge, I would say definitely, definitely go by your heart center. Try as much as possible not to get swept up, get caught up in your headspace, and get swept away by all these feelings and emotions, because some of the ETs, the mantis beings, are notorious for this, especially the big overgrown ones, the ones that, you know, oftentimes the mantis will present themselves as females, like these big females, you know, squatting there with the, you know, the bent forearms, and I'm not talking about the mantid, the smaller mantids or the smaller mantid hybrids. I'm talking about the ones that look like big, overgrown, praying mantises. And interestingly enough, these praying mantises can work through quote-unquote regular praying mantises here on the surface, the kind that we commonly, you know, think of that, you know, live in the wild or which farmers can go out and buy, you know, as a, you know, safe, cost-effective, environmentally cool way of getting rid of pests, right? They actually go out and buy praying mantises. But these praying mantises, these regular-sized praying mantises, insects, they figure prominently in the experiences of people who really have mantis ET experiences. But getting back to the overgrown mantis beings, they are renowned for manipulating the part of our mind and our endocrinary system. So we're flooded with these energetic waves, and it varies from feeling love coming out of them. Oh, I felt so much love coming out of this overgrown insect, right? Or conversely, they can exude this energy, which is perceived by the abductee as omniscience, all-knowing, all-wise, coming out of the mantis being. And you often hear this with people who don't know any better because they get caught up in all the emotions, the emotional aspect of it. They'll tell you, I felt such wisdom and such knowledge and such love coming out of this overgrown bug, this mantis being, right? But really, it's just a manipulation. It's just an illusion. It's just the entity utilizing either its superior brain power or technology to manipulate our physiology, our endocrinary system, our glandular system, our neurology, and make us think that it's just full of love and full of wisdom, right? And some of the smaller tannish ETs are known to do this too, where they can just exude this kind of aura of love, just love, love, love. And the point of relevance, folks, is, okay, those are fake implanted feelings. Don't get caught up in them. Go with what your heart center tells you. And say even if you get caught up momentarily in the midst of the experience with the whole, you know, all the love bombing, right? Afterwards, you can sit and ask yourself a simple yes-no question. Were those entities deceptive? Were they making me feel all this, you know, lovey-dovey stuff? And you tune into your heart center, and your heart center will tell you. It'll give you a simple yes-no answer. discordant kind of, you know, feeling in your heart center is a no. A pleasant kind of heart energetic sensation is a yes. So after the fact, you can ask your heart center, which is connected to source and connected to your oversoul, it'll tell you. And so it's important not to get caught up in the emotional thing. And also the ego activation. The entities always strive to activate your ego, right? Make you feel special. Again, there's an emotional component. And if you're someone who's come from a shame base, as we just about all of us have, a shame-based background, and maybe there's been a lot of trauma, unremembered trauma from previous ET abductions, etc. And also, if there was trauma, psychological and physical trauma from your upbringing, whether it was from, you know, abusive narcissistic family members, abusive narcissistic people outside of the family, whatever the case may be, all of that will work against you. And so when the ETs come along and try to activate your ego and tell you you're special and pat you on the head and leave you with feel-good memories, right? There should never be an incongruent aspect to it. Because what happens sometimes, what I've observed with these people who only believe they've only had positive encounters with positive ETs is, when one starts mentioning negative ET encounters, and oh boy, don't mention reptilians around, you know, the love and lighters, because just the subject matter, the reptilians, triggers the hell out of them. That is a red flag. If they're as grounded and centered and heart-centered as they claim to be, it will not derive a negative reaction. Oh, don't talk about that. That's too negative. Or I don't believe reptilians exist. Or you're just a fear-based person. That's outward projection from people that have been severely damaged and traumatized and haven't worked with their inner shadow and have not processed all that trauma, right? So that is a red flag if they start acting out and responding negatively. And also there are more subtle ways they can respond. Like you start talking about alien abduction experiences, you know, the painful medical procedures and the psychological mucking around they do, the alien love bite, etc., etc. They either get agitated or they, you know, reach for a cigarette and light one up, or they get up and walk away. They start falling asleep. Okay, those are all triggered program responses. Warm and fuzzy ETs wouldn't program people to respond in that way. So that's a red flag. And also, you know, before this first segment is over, another aspect of this is the importance of listening to one's own self. I talked about the heart center, right? But we do pick up energies. We do detect energies with our energetic field, with our physical body. And so we have to start to learn what our body, physical body, and what our energetic body and what our heart center is trying to tell us. If we feel a discordant rumbling in our solar plexus, well, we need to pay attention to that. If we start to get a prodromal feeling, like you know, as it gets closer to nightfall and we're getting ready for bed, we start to feel anxious and you know, start to feel anxiety, start to feel nervous, we need to pay attention to that. It may mean that these ETs, these negative ETs, are tuning into us and maybe coming for us and try to abduct us or manipulate us. And it must be understood, folks, that a lot of these abducting ETs will abduct us and mess with us right in our own bedrooms. Like the David Jacobs of the world, that hammer you repeatedly with notions of you driving along at night and they're abducting you, et cetera, and seeing aliens next to your parked car. Well, that happens too, but just as often they'll mess with you in your own bedroom. So if you do encounter beings and you're curious as to their intentions, right, the craft of intelligence is determining the intentions and capabilities of a foe or a potential foe. So if they're love bombing you, if they're trying to make you feel special and activate your ego, all of those are red flags. On the other hand, if these are ET races that are trying to help you when you're going through like periods of crisis, that are reminding you of some kind of destiny, or trying to remind you that your experiences with negative ETs are real, but they're not the only ETs out there, that there are good ETs. These good ETs will show you symbolic imagery in the dreams. They will take you on higher dimensional excursions and show you things. But again, you have to be discerning, because negative ETs will do the same thing. So you have to ask yourself, after all is said and done, well, that really interesting mystical experience I had last night, was that with good ETs, bad ETs, or, you know, what's the deal? Go within, ask your heart center to come up with an energetic yay or nay answer, and it'll let you know. And also, there are certain grounding tools you can use, like certain tensors and certain stones like hematite. When you work with them, they're very good at keeping you embodied, keeping you grounded, and that helps you to plug into your heart center even more. So I hope I answered your question there, Dean.
You did, and I think we're running out of time in this hour, but before we get into the second hour and maybe also a little bit afterwards, can you talk a little bit about that artificial intelligence matrix aspect to everything? Because a lot of people feel like we're living in some kind of a matrix reality with artificial intelligence coming in. So tell us what you think about that.
Well, it's real. It's unfortunately very real. Being a podcaster, I've had to deal with a lot of this, where my recording software was interfered with, where the recordings, which I thought were pristine and perfect at the time of recording, later on, when I get down to editing and working with it and turning them into movies on YouTube, I find out they're all messed up and, in some cases, unsalvageable, where it would just, even if I spent hours and hours and days trying to salvage these recordings, they still wouldn't sound professional or sound good and would just be like an earache to listen to. We just talked about Silicon Valley, and we talked about how at least some, the potential exists for at least some of those engineers, many of whom, some of whom, are alien hybrids to begin with, right? Plugged into this hive consciousness, that they're coming up with all these great ideas for what at least the ostensible purpose is to make life easier for us in the form of advanced intelligence, artificial intelligence, technology, interfacing with our technology, with our equipment, with our machines, in theory, making life easier for us. I was just reading an article the other day, Dean, about how drivers will be obsolete for cars. That, you know, if they decide to go in a certain direction with motor vehicles, it'll be an onboard computer that drives cars nowadays or in the future. That's one potential future. But that is tinged with all kinds of risk, all kinds of potential further intrusions upon our personal sovereignty. Because what if somebody gets into their car one fine day, and then next thing you know, the car is driving them to some detention, brainwashing, artificial intelligence center, right? And they come out looking like a Borg or something. I mean, the potential exists for all of the above. Because nanotechnology being what it is, because so many of these weapon systems, is what I regard them as, artificial intelligence, is binary and multiple weapons platforms all working in unison. So you may not only have nanotechnology inserted into your bloodstream and subcutaneously via immunizations / vaccines, but also through GMO food, also through the chemtrailing and the heavy metals and particulates that are found in, known to be in chemtrails. And also, on top of that, the energetic beaming of the carrier wave frequencies that are beamed out that activate, make active the nanotech within us to operate in a certain way. It all works together. So because of miniaturization, all that is possible. And so we have a system where, through a variety of means, they want to dull human consciousness. David Icke talks about this in his current world lecture tour. He spends a considerable necessary amount of time talking about the true nature of consciousness and how it's intentionally muted by the archons and by the hybrid humans working for the archons, and increasingly by this artificial intelligence. So not only is the consciousness muted in humans, who we're supposed to be, right? We're supposed to believe we're the most advanced life forms on this planet, and we're just We're so dumbed down, we don't even recognize the nature of the multiple threat environment in which we reside. I mean, if you put like a McDonald's Happy Meal down on the ground right next to an ant trail, they won't even deviate. They won't even investigate. The scouts won't even mess with it because the ants don't regard it as food. They see it as something else, something potentially dangerous. And those are ants, and we're supposed to be more advanced than ants. But humans, many humans, they can't tell the difference because it looks like food, what they've been conditioned to believe food is. And everything has an energetic signature. So definitely, AI will start to manifest itself. And everything that we've talked about thus far is just surface-level AI. The AI that Dean and I know and talk about and some of our colleagues talk about is much more pervasive, invasive. It's kind of an everywhere issue in our planet, in our sphere of influence. We're going to have Laura Leone come back on the show, and she talks about AI and organic AI, and I think there's a key difference, and I'll have her explain that. But long and the short of it, Dean, is that some of the aliens are, basically pushing this AI, and they're working through their hybrid minions on Earth. And I think that a lot of the alien races that are more spiritually evolved, higher dimensional, they know the potential problems that the AI can create. Some of these alien races want nothing to do with AI, and they would hope that we're smart enough, we humans, to disengage from it while there's still time, because we've talked in the past about the incessant soul harvesting recycling. If the AI takes over, if it reaches its full potential and reaches a point of no return, I really worry about the state of our what passes or what people call our souls, because if we're plugged into some huge artificial intelligence system, there may be no going back, right? We may be stuck within the confines of an artificial virtual reality forever, basically. So we really have to detach from all of this and get back to our connection to organic source.
Well, thank you for all that great information. And we've got a lot more coming up in the second hour that I'm sure is going to interest you. I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners, our members, everybody who posts on our forum and supports our show in any way, shape, or form, because we couldn't do that without you. We get a lot of sophisticated attacks against our web servers, and without the support from our listeners, we just wouldn't have the time or the motivation to keep this show going. So I just wanted to thank everybody who listens and visits our website. So we'll see you on the next side for the next hour of this interview.